Talk Shoes. Recorded live.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Pastor Eli James, along with Pastor William Fink, for another installment of Yahweh's Covenant People. And I haven't been watching television all week. Actually, I haven't been watching television much at all lately at all, even though I think probably if you're watching the sports channel or sports news, you've probably had enough of football hype already. So, I like to call it the Stupor Bowl, because after all the hype, by the time you watch the game, you're in a stupor. But I have to say, a couple of the commercials are that I saw on the internet that apparently are going to be shown during the Super Bowl are just outrageous. One of them is, I can't remember if it's Miller or Bush, or what beer company it is. But it's an office setting, and a lady is walking up to the guys in the office and says, "I'm taking a clothing drive, and any man who donates a piece of clothing gets a free Miller Lite," or whatever brand of beer it was, I can't remember. So all the guys in the office start taking off their clothes, okay? And a bunch of them stripped down naked, and there's a little highlight above their genital areas while they're walking around and getting on elevators and stuff. This is commercial television, folks.
Well, it's typical. When you see the Jews, you see perversion.
That's right.
When they're running things, that's what you're going to see.
It's total perversion.
It proves that Satan's in charge.
Yeah, right. And then there was, and this was unbelievable. I don't know if they're going to show this at the Super Bowl, but it was you probably saw the ads from Las Vegas, you know, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas, except the clap, you know, that famous commercial from Las Vegas. Well, there's one from London.
I'm sorry, I haven't seen the commercial.
Yeah, and this London commercial, it's a London tourism commercial. And there's a lady walking across a bridge. It's a steel bridge. Okay, and she's walking real slowly across this bridge, very sensuously, right, and touching the handrails as she's walking across the bridge. And she finally gets to the other side, and she bends over, and, of course, the camera's focusing on her ass, right, as she's bending over, and her skirt kind of raises up as she bends over. And then the bridge that she just walked across has an erection, okay? So the bridge raises up. I mean, it's very obvious what's happening, right? And this is the London Tourism Bureau. It's absolutely incredible.
And in reality, 20 Muslims have come along and raped her and leave her half dead under the bridge.
Right. There you go. This is where advertising at. This is where commercialism is at.
Well, Satan, Satan has taken over completely. And it's every way you look, you see it.
Yeah, I'll have to see. I was sort of disgusted with that commercial, so I should have kept it.
Well, that's why I'm being honest. I'm not kidding when I say that. You know, I can probably count all the hours I watched TV the last 20 years on one hand.
Yeah, yeah.
And I might only need like a couple of fingers too. I remember watching. I watched about an hour of the Country Music Awards with some of the guys in prison maybe about 5 years ago. And then I just because I was curious, and I watched about 20 or 30 minutes of television when 9/11 happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in prison, and I heard it on the radio, so I went and watched CNN or Fox News, whatever they had on for 20 or 30 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was my, from 96 until today, that was my total TV viewing.
Right. Very good. I have to say I haven't gone to a theater since, probably the mid-80s.
Right, the last movie I saw was Braveheart.
Uh-huh, yeah. Gerald says global warming is hell. Yeah, it's killing Washington, D.C. 2 feet of snow.
Yeah, I got an email from Ken Lent, and he's down in southwestern Virginia. I got an email from him today, and he told me he had 26 inches of ice pellets.
Wow.
He was under. Wow. And I kind of wrote him back, "Hey, why don't you come to New York to escape the cold and the snow?"
Right. We just got a dusting here in Chicago, less than an inch. you know, but the southeast and the east coast are really getting it hard.
Well, something's up this year. I mean, I remember when I came home last year, I shoveled every damn day. You know, every day I was out there almost with a shovel. This year, I shoveled once.
Mm-hmm.
I have shoveled once so far this year.
Yeah.
And that was about 4 inches of fluff.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it.
Yeah, same here. I've only shoveled once, yeah.
I mean, I should probably keep my mouth shut. I shouldn't complain.
Well, winter's almost over. Can't be too much left. Yeah. But, yeah, it's obvious that the end times, you know, the storms, the earthquakes, it's all happening, you know, and it's all accelerating. So the prophecies about these end times,
your hope.
Yeah, they're upon us, you know, and we should rejoice. We Israelites should be rejoiced because that means the second coming of Yahshua is very near.
I know I have a cousin that left New York and moved to Texas 3 years ago, and she's old. She's 72, and she wanted to get away from the bad weather, so she moved to Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And she's had more snow down there than we've had here this year.
Right. Fascinating. Yeah. Oh, by the way, just off the cuff, I'm not suggesting this is true in any way, but the inside information I have is that there may be a like Haiti, it was obviously a HAARP attack. There's no doubt about it. It was a deliberate manufactured earthquake. But what I'm hearing is that Las Vegas may be next. So anybody in the Las Vegas area, be careful, okay? That's what I'm hearing, okay? So anyway, let's go into – before we go into the Pascal's Wager, I just want to back up the fact that Paul does not teach against the law. He absolutely does tell us not to violate the law, that we should not do evil, and that we should always do good. Okay, so anybody who says that Paul is an antinomian, says that the good works are not necessary and that we don't need to obey the law, I mean, they're a liar. I'm going to quote a bunch of statements by Paul taken from various of his epistles. First, Romans 2:9, tribulation and anguish upon every soul that doeth evil. Okay, he's not being nice to these people. He says, upon you who do evil, tribulation and anguish should come. Okay? Yeah. Greg said, yeah, we should level Hollywood next. Yeah, well, they'll probably take care of that themselves. Romans 3:8. And not rather as we be slanderously reported. This is interesting here. As some affirm that we say, let us do evil, that good may come, whose damnation is just. In fact, here in Romans 3:8, he's anticipating those who will call him an antinomian. As we slanderously reported, as some affirm that we say. Okay, they're not. That's what people are saying about Paul, that he's an antinomian. It's okay to do evil.
Well, you know, Christ, the law was fulfilled, but we're to keep the law. It's very clear.
Yeah, that's right.
And he was. We're just not to be judged by it, and we're to put away the ritual sacrifices.
Yeah.
So right away, the Jews, because the Christians wanted to do away with all of the rituals and dispose of the judgments of the law,
right?
That they accused them of wanting to be lawless and doing away with the law itself.
Right, yeah, because they equated the law exclusively with the rituals.
Right, and the rituals were the power of the priest.
That's right. That's right.
Just like today, the power of the priest is in the tithe and in the baptism and in the confirmation and the communion and making you believe that you have to do all that stuff.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's the power of the priest. And it was the same thing then.
Yes, yes. Romans 12:9, let love be without dissimulation. Abhor that which is evil. Cleave to that which is good. Romans 12:21, be not overcome of evil, but overcome evil with good. Romans 13:3, for rulers are not a terror to good works, but to the evil. Wilt thou then not be afraid of the power? Do that which is good, and thou shalt have praise. Romans 14:16, let not then your good be evil spoken of. Don't let other people trash your good works. Romans 14:20, for meat, I don't know if this is correctly printed here, for meat, destroy not the work of God.
You must not destroy the work of Yahweh on account of food.
On account of food.
He was talking about meat sacrificed to idols. That's the context.
That, you know,
if you couldn't buy meat in ancient Corinth, it wasn't sacrificed to idols.
That was the
that was the civil situation. If you didn't own a farm, you couldn't obtain meat.
Right. Yeah, you had to buy it because the whole area was.
And that was the cause of great consternation amongst the Corinthians, and that was the topic of this epistle,
right?
In these chapters.
Yeah, so he told them, and let me finish the rest of the verse here. All things are indeed pure, but it is evil that for that man who eateth with offense. So a lot of people want to criticize Paul here for saying everything that you eat, they assume that he meant pork, too. Okay.
Yeah, right, and pork is not food. So
that's right.
I mean pork.
That's what
pork
they don't get.
Food.
Yes. Okay. A couple more here. 1 Corinthians 13:5. Doth not behave itself unseemly, seek not her own, think no evil. I cut in the middle of the verse here. Think no evil, in other words. Okay. Be not deceived. This is 1 Corinthians 15:33. Be not deceived. Evil communications corrupt good manners. 2 Corinthians 13.
And that's actually, let me say that that's a Greek proverb.
Okay.
I find that in Diodorus Siculus and a couple other writers too.
Okay. Very interesting. Okay. 2 Corinthians 13:7. Now I pray to God that you do no evil, not that we should appear approved, but that you should do that which is honest, though we be as reprobates. Of course, it's self-deprecation here, but he's still saying do not do any evil. Ephesians 4:31, let all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamor and evil speaking be put away from you with all malice. Ephesians 6:13, wherefore take unto you the whole armor of God that ye may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all to stand. So we are to avoid evil. We are simply to avoid evil.
Did you quote Romans 3:31? Did I miss that?
Let me turn back the page here. 3, no, I didn't. It's not on my list here.
Do we then nullify the law by faith? Certainly not. Rather, we establish the law.
Uh-huh. Right. Exactly. Very good. Okay, and then one more, Philippians 3:2. Beware of dogs. Beware of evil workers. Beware of the concision, which seems to mean schism. So beware of those who want to produce a schism in the church over this.
The concision is a cutting. It's the circumcision, basically.
Okay. Okay.
That's what he's warning about.
Okay. So, and then Colossians 3:5, mortify therefore your members which are upon the earth, fornication, uncleanness, inordinate affection, evil concupiscence, which means lust, excessive sexual desire, covetousness, which is idolatry. So, all of these things which the antinomians say, well, these no longer are important and we shouldn't concern ourselves with these things. Paul was saying the exact opposite. Yes, we should. We are not to engage in these things. And they're forbidden to us. Okay? All right, so.
When we discussed this program, you would talk about Marcion.
Yes. Oh, right. I forgot the page on Marcion. But essentially, as I understand Marcion's doctrine, is that he was the first person to declare that the Old Testament was evil, that the God of the Old Testament was brutal and harsh, okay, and that therefore we should only rely on the New Testament.
Well, right, and that's a very old heresy. And,
yes.
And I just want to say that, you know, that Eusebius calls him a heresiarch,
mm-hmm.
meaning the leader of a heresy, right?
Okay.
And Jerome tells us that he was an antinomian.
Right.
And Jerome basically, he makes a statement in passing that I have a quote of, I say these things not that I may, like Manichaeus and Marcion, destroy the law.
Mm-hmm.
Which I know on the testimony of the apostle, which means Paul, to be both holy and spiritual. Okay, so you know, Jerome is an upholder of the law in saying that Marcion is basically an antinomian.
Right, right. So that antinomianism began with Marcion, and Marcion claimed to be a disciple of Paul. Okay, he built up Paul in his own fashion.
And here Jerome is saying that, you know, he's contrary to Paul.
Right, right. And of course, we have the same situation today.
Because it's Paul that said that the law is spiritual and holy and just and good.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's right. So here, so Marcion would be the first example of someone claiming that Paul is an antinomian. Okay? And so that's been going on for the last 2,000 years. And so anybody who believes that stuff, you could see it. And of course, didn't Paul warn us that there are false teachers? Peter, I think it was Peter, said false teachers crept in unawares. I think Paul may have said that too. So we have to watch out for these people who claim to, again, no author can be judged by the way his work is translated. And therefore, you have to understand that some people who translated Paul's work have an agenda. Obviously, the Catholic Church had a universalist agenda in translating his work. Obviously, the KJV translators had an agenda in universalizing his work. And the whole evangelical crowd have an agenda of universalizing his work. So, you know, it's such a broad mass scale redaction and reinterpretation and retranslation of Paul's writings that no wonder people believe that Paul is an antinomian universalist and blah, blah, blah. You know, it's because they've done a number on his original Greek writings. They surely, most surely have.
And according to Augustine, Marcion, I say Marcion because the C was always hard in Latin.
Right.
I'm sorry. That the he was also a claimed the fact that he claimed as fact that Christ didn't have a real body. He was an apparition all along. So the guy was out there.
He was out there.
So were the churches of today.
Yeah, that would be Gnosticism. Yeah, that would be a Gnostic doctrine that he didn't actually have a physical body. Well, if he didn't have a physical body, then the death on the cross is meaningless. There was really no death on the cross. It was just an illusion.
Well, right. And that's
okay.
That's Jewish sophism, at least, at the least.
Yeah, right, right. Okay, so let's get back into Pascal's wager, and this is from a document.
Well, let's explain what Pascal's wager was. This guy's writing against Pascal's wager. Pascal was like an 18th century, I think, or 17th century French philosopher.
Okay.
And he was one of the philosophers to kind of say that, like, You should bet that God exists, and then you'll be on the safe side.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you know, we don't know if he exists, but if you bet he exists, you'll be safe.
Yeah.
That's Pascal's wager.
Okay.
It sums up in a nutshell.
Yeah. Yeah, which is kind of safe.
And this Jew that you're quoting from.
Yeah, Paul Tobin.
He's writing against the rejection of Pascal's wager.
Yeah. So his motivation is to deny the existence of God, okay? And so he's an Antichrist Jew, okay? And so he is now trying to make the claim in this document. Let me flip back here and get the title of the document. Rejection of Pascal's Wager, Opposition to Paul from the Jerusalem Church. Okay, so his whole premise here is that Paul's main opponents in the spreading of his gospel, which, of course, all the Paul bashers say it's Paul's gospel, it's not the gospel of Jesus Christ, or the gospel of Yahshua or Yahweh. They say it's Paul's gospel. And, of course, this author, Paul Tobin, is going a long way in promoting that idea. And so his basic premise in this article is to suggest that Paul had only one real opposing group, and that was James, Peter, and John in Jerusalem, the big three of the Jerusalem church. And he uses this expression, the Jerusalem church, constantly,
and this is pertinent because some people might wonder why this is pertinent, but this is pertinent because this is the same argument that the Paul bashers use.
Right.
It's the same exact argument that the Paul bashers use to discredit Paul. The Paul Bashers in Christian Identity,
yes,
or to claim to be Christian. They can't possibly be Christian Identity. Okay. But they use this argument to discredit Paul.
Yes, yes. Okay. And so let me go to Galatians 2, 1, 2, where in this article he quotes Galatians 2, 1 and 2. Then after 14 years, and he says, that this is, wait a minute. Let me back up one paragraph here. From Paul's defense above, and I think we quoted this last week, and he's talking about the fact that Paul refused to take money for serving the Corinthian church and other such accusations, which he claims are, you know, significant accusations that, from the Jerusalem church, okay? And so we have to find out whether or not these accusations are actually coming from Peter, James, and John, you know, which he asserts is the case, okay? Paul, an apostle, he's quoting Galatians 1:1 here, not from men nor through man, but through Jesus Christ and God the Father, Galatians 11 and 12, for I would have you know, brethren, that the gospel which was preached by me is not man's gospel, for I did not receive it from man, nor was I taught it, but it came through a revelation of Jesus Christ. Okay, so now he's doubting this claim. Quote, from Paul's defense above, we can infer with some certainty that the opposing mission claimed that he received his gospel from some people. Okay, well, obviously, his opponents, whoever they were, what he's saying is that these people gave it to Paul, okay, and Paul somehow is doing the work of some other group.
Well, not what Paul's answering to.
No, okay, go ahead.
Yeah, you know, Paul is saying that he got his revelation straight from Christ.
That's right. That's exactly what it says in the verse.
and that doesn't mean, but that Paul's statement doesn't necessitate that it answers to such a charge.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, you know, there's absolutely no evidence of such a charge.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I was going to ask. Was there an accusation of this kind? And
no,
there's no evidence
at all that Paul's answering to an accusation at all.
Uh-huh.
He's basically saying that he's as good as the other apostles because his revelation also came to Christ.
Right, from Christ,
right.
Yes. Yes.
That's all he's saying. He's not,
yeah,
answering an accusation that you know, that his gospel really came from Jaime around the corner in Bethesda.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah, and so this is how Paul Tobin is distorting these verses, claiming that there's some accusation here, which no one has actually made.
Right. Now, the problem is that Tobin is saying that, you know, that the Jerusalem church is accusing Paul of not accepting the support of the Corinthians.
Mm-hmm.
That's what Tobin is saying.
Right.
And he's manufacturing this out of the text.
Right.
He's making an argument by borrowing bits and pieces of the text, and he's making an argument that isn't there.
Exactly.
Only way, you know, the best way, the easiest way to see the fallacy of his argument is this. Why, if the Jerusalem church was accusing Paul of not taking money and support from the Corinthians,
mm-hmm,
why is Paul asking the Corinthians to take up a collection and, you know, assign somebody to accompany that collection to the saints in Jerusalem from the Corinthians?
Right, right. Why would he be giving them money?
Right. Exactly. And the Corinthians' money.
Yeah.
And while they're accusing him. That makes no sense at all.
Right. It absolutely makes no sense. So you have to be ignorant of the context of Corinthians and Galatians.
Well, the Jews, every time they lie, they bet on Christian ignorance.
Right.
And they're usually right.
That's right. That's right. That's absolutely right. Okay. So let me continue here. Let me just repeat this sentence. From Paul's defense above, we can infer with some certainty, okay, he never says, you know, he always uses these oblique terms, okay, with some certainty, there's probable evidence, or there's good indication, okay, these are the kinds of terms he used. He never comes up with any proof.
Because he said so.
Yeah, he never comes up with any proof. It's always innuendo, okay? Now, so who are these people? Okay, the only people, he says, Paul talked to about in the first two chapters were the Jerusalem pillars, James, Peter, and John. We will see that his description of them during the Jerusalem Council was, to put it mildly, less than flattering. So he quotes Galatians 2, 1 and 2 here now. Then after 14 years, I went up again to Jerusalem with Barnabas, taking Titus along with me. I went up by revelation. And I laid before them, but privately before those who were of repute, the gospel which I preach among the nations, lest somehow I should be running or had run in vain. Of course, he uses the word Gentiles here, and he uses the word Gentiles to mean non-Israelites. Okay, this is part of the fallacy here. Then Galatians 2:6-6, and from those who were reputed to be something, what they were made no what they are or what they were makes no difference to me, Paul is saying. God shows no partiality. Those, I say, who were of repute added nothing to me. And then he quotes Galatians 2:9. And when they perceived the grace that was given to me, James and Cephas and John, who were reputed to be pillars, gave to me and Barnabas the right hand of fellowship. Now here's what he has to say. The root of the Greek words used above, translated into English as of repute or reputed to be, is the same dokeo, meaning to seem, to suppose. C.K. Barrett has argued that these words in common coined Greek usage very probably imply some kind of deception. Whether
they don't imply any deception at all.
Right. Okay.
The word can mean, it's reputed in my translation.
Reputed, okay.
In this context. And it could mean, it's reputed in a sense also, the positive sense would be esteemed.
Okay.
Okay, and the word, and I have translated dokeo as esteemed, and I've translated it as supposed, and a lot of it depends on the context.
Right.
But reputed is not necessarily being used in a negative sense.
Right.
And it's certainly not implying any form of deception.
Right. Right.
And that's not ever read into the definition so far as I've ever seen.
Yeah, yeah. So what he's saying here that Paul is being coy. That's what he's saying, okay? By saying, oh, these reputed fellows from Jerusalem, okay? That's what he's saying. He's saying that Paul is being coy. Let me continue here. Thus, the thrust of Paul's reference to the Jerusalem pillars here is that they, quote, seem to think, or were, quote, supposed to be important.
No. They're reputed to be pillars because all of the Christian people esteem them.
Right.
And right. What Paul is saying is that he's not short of them, or he's their equal in knowledge in every respect.
Right.
Okay. He's making a claim that he knows as much as they do about the gospel.
Right, right. But continuing with the thought that he is implying that Paul is being coy here, but as he added in Galatians 2:6, it, quote, makes no difference, unquote, to him. Thus, this is his conclusion, thus these passages were a conscious attempt by Paul to minimize the importance of the Jerusalem leadership of James, Peter, and John.
Now that's not true at all.
Uh-huh.
That's something that, just because Paul asserts that he is on their level, that doesn't diminish them.
Right.
That doesn't diminish them at all.
Yeah, exactly. But if he's being coy, you know, if he's being devious and coy, as Tobin is implying, well, then yes. Then he would be demeaning them. But there's no, you know, there's no reason for Paul to be coy or demeaning.
No, absolutely not.
Right.
It's Tobin being coy.
Exactly. There you go.
Let me
give
a quick rundown on Paul's connections to the people in Jerusalem,
okay.
To James and to Peter.
Yes.
In the crucifixion is in 32 AD. Okay? And Paul, sometime after that, is converted on the road to Damascus.
Mm-hmm.
Let's call it a year. All right? Because, you know, he goes back and forth to Damascus. Stephen stoned. He spoils the assembly in Damascus and harasses them. And he goes back to Jerusalem, and he's on his way to Damascus with letters. And he's converted in that period of time. And let's call it a year, and let's say it's 33.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it could be 34.
Sure.
Yeah, you know, but it's not long after the crucifixion.
Right.
So now Paul says that after his conversion on the road to Damascus, he spends 3 years in virtual seclusion. You know, goes to the deserts in seclusion and spends, after 3 years,
right.
He goes back to Damascus, and after 3 years, he returns to Jerusalem. So now it's like 36 AD.
Okay.
And then he goes out on a mission, on a gospel mission, and after 14 years he returns, or 15 years he returns,
mm-hmm.
and he, you know, this is when we have the event at Antioch, and it's 51 A.D.
Okay.
Okay. And in Galatians chapter 1, Paul is talking about, in Galatians 1:18, where Paul mentions Cephas, he, you know, after 3 years, he went up to relate an account to Cephas. That's 36 A.D.
Mm-hmm.
And in Galatians chapter 2, where he has the, where he admonishes Peter at Antioch, which is what he's describing there.
Yeah.
Now, he has no, there's no enmity described between Paul and James in Galatians 2.
Okay.
He only admonishes Peter at Antioch because Peter, when he's not with the people from Jerusalem, he's eating with the uncircumcised.
Right.
And when the people from Jerusalem come to Antioch, Peter withdraws from the uncircumcised.
Yes.
And Paul's calling him the hypocrite.
Right.
And it's a correct, you know, if Peter was doing that, then Paul's right to do that.
Exactly.
And what Paul is saying is that, hey, I'm as good as these guys, and I'm not going to let them get away with hypocrisy.
Right. Right.
And that's the explanation of Galatians 2, and it concerns 51 A.D.
Yes.
Now the epistles to the Galatians and to the two epistles to the Corinthians, they were written probably between 53 and 55 A.D.
Okay.
Now, Paul finally gets to Jerusalem in 57 A.D.
Okay.
And we know it's 57 A.D. because that's when he's arrested.
Uh-huh.
And we know when he's arrested because of the times that we can determine from Roman records and from Josephus as to when Festus and when Felix were the governors of Judea.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Okay. Paul is 57 A.D. He sees James. There's no mention when he sees James of any enmity at all.
Mm-hmm.
Between Paul and the other apostles.
That's right.
Now, in this same period of time, Peter writes his epistle to the assemblies in Asia.
Okay.
And commends Paul.
Right.
He commends Paul.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no mention of any enmity at all.
Right.
With Paul in Peter's epistles.
Exactly.
Now, Paul sees James in Jerusalem, and James says, look, all these people in Jerusalem. Now, James is not accusing Paul.
Right.
This is in Acts chapter 22, I believe. Or I'm sorry, it might be Acts chapter 25. I think it's Acts chapter 22.
Okay.
And James is by no means accusing Paul, but James tells Paul, look, all these people in Jerusalem, thousands of these people are zealous of the law, and they think you're a teacher against the law.
Right.
So go cleanse yourself in the temple. So does Paul argue with James? No.
Mm-hmm.
He accedes to James.
Yes.
And he does that because James is his elder.
Right, right.
And so also, Paul respects his elder and goes along with it and goes and cleanses himself in the temple and gets in a jam with the Jews and gets locked up.
Right.
Yeah. And never
even
sees
though he washed
James
himself.
Now Paul is arrested and spends 2 years in custody.
Right. And Paul is even circumcised.
Right.
Yeah.
Now Paul spends 2 years in custody, and he gets sent to Rome.
Mm-hmm.
Now Paul gets sent to Rome in 60 A.D. James dies at the hands of the Jews in 62.
Mm-hmm.
They never see each other again.
Right.
But there's no mention of enmity between them.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
not.
Paul acceded to James's wishes.
Right. Tobin is simply creating this enmity, this animosity or competition, however you want to describe it, between the three pillars in Jerusalem versus Paul. He's just making it up out of whole cloth. There's no evidence of this animosity between these two at all. Absolutely none. And he's just, what he's doing, this is very, very sophisticated and clever deception to twisting words and, again, relying on the ignorance of the Judeo-Christian readership. But actually, I think this is more sophisticated than that. This document is designed to feed the suspicions of the Paul bashers, those who are already convinced that Paul is a Jew, that Paul is an antinomian, and he's a universalist and all that stuff.
Well, it's Jewish seduction, right?
That's right.
It's what they're best at.
Yeah, because what he's doing is laying more suspicion. He's laying more suspicion upon Paul, more innuendo, more false accusations, none of which have any basis in reality, and certainly not in Scripture. So that people who are already prone to be against Paul, when they read this, they're going to hate Paul. And Paul Tobin knows exactly what he's doing. Okay? Let's go to Galatians 2:11-14, where he quotes, "But when Cephas," that is Peter, "came to Antioch, I opposed him to his face," and I think this is the one you were just talking about, "because he stood condemned. For before certain men came from James, he ate with the Gentiles." In fact, this is exactly the verse you were just talking about. "He ate with the Gentiles," or as you said, with the uncircumcised, being the uncircumcised Israelites. Right. And this word Gentiles, of course, has fooled everybody into believing that Paul was the missionary to the non-Israelites. Folks, that's not true. This word Gentile doesn't mean that. In the Latin, it means kinsman. Okay? But the Jews have redefined it to mean non-Israelite. And everybody in the Judeo-Christian world believes that definition. It's a false definition. So let's continue. I'll quote it as he quotes it, because this feeds into the suspicions of people. "But before certain men came from James, he ate with the Gentiles. But when they came, he drew back and separated himself, fearing the circumcision party." That's a blatantly honest statement by Paul. That are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, because I thought I lost connection there for a second.
You're just not used to me being quiet.
Yeah, right. What happened? And so that's a blatantly honest statement. He's saying that Peter, for fear of being embarrassed by the circumcision party, left the company of the uncircumcision. That's exactly what happened. Okay.
And that's you know James is in Acts 22, where James says to Paul that there are tens of thousands of people here in Jerusalem, all zealous of the law. He seems to fear the circumcision.
Right. That's right. That's right. So then he says, "And the rest of the Jews joined him in this hypocrisy, so that even Barnabas was carried away by their hypocrisy. But when I saw that they were not acting consistently with the truth of the gospel, I said to Peter before them all, quote, 'If you, though being a Judean, live like a Gentile and not like a Judean, how can you compel the Gentiles to live like Jews?'" Okay? So he's being, you know, he's accusing Peter to his face, saying, "You're being hypocritical when the circumcision is not around, when these Jews, when these Judaizers are not around, you keep company with the uncircumcision, and then when you see him coming, you pretend that you're not having anything to do with the uncircumcision." Now, who's right and who's wrong in this case?
Well, it's evident that that's what Peter is doing, and in his epistles, Peter's silent on the issue.
Right.
And commends Paul. And I think that if Peter was right and Paul was wrong, that we would have heard something about it.
Exactly.
From original sources, not from this Jew
right.
2,000 right. years later.
Okay, now here's what Tobin had to say. "Again, note the protagonist that Paul have placed opposite himself. It was Peter. After receiving instructions from James, who was compelling Gentiles to live like Jews. Paul, of course," as if this was a good thing. Paul is suggesting that this is a good thing. "Paul, of course, labeled such actions hypocrisy. The important point to note here is that Paul is giving the Galatians an example of how he had stood up to the Judaizing party." Well, that's good. That's you know, Paul was standing up to the Judaizers.
And Tobin's taking it for granted that Christians should become like Jews.
Right, exactly, exactly. "In that example, his opponents were the pillars themselves, James and Peter." Okay. "These emphatic declarations of independence from the Jerusalem church was," let me ask you here, let me finish a sentence. "These emphatic declarations of independence from the Jerusalem church, the purposeful minimization of the importance of the leadership and the example of the incident at Antioch, all point us to the accusation being made against him by the opposing mission. They also tell us the identity of the accusers." Now, there's several deceptions going on in these two sentences.
Well, yeah, there's a lot of deceptions. First, why is it a church in Jerusalem?
Right.
Oh, why isn't it just an assembly of people that's no better than any other assembly of people?
Yes, yes.
That's the Christian ideal.
Yeah.
And, of course, the Jew is never going to understand that.
Right, well, because they worship their own rabbinate.
Well, right. They have no importance in the first place.
Right.
Now,
right.
Now, when Paul left Jerusalem in I estimate it to be 51 A.D., and that's the events of Acts chapter 15.
Yeah.
And let me say that we know for sure that the events of Acts chapter 12, Herod's murder of James, that happened around 44 A.D.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Oh, okay. So these dates, a lot of these dates can be pretty much nailed down.
Right. Right.
Well, when Paul left Jerusalem, he pretty much had an agreement with the other apostles that he would, you know, be that they would Peter would go to the circumcision,
mm-hmm.
and that Paul and Barnabas would go to the uncircumcised, the dispersed of Israel,
right,
the heathen Israelites,
yes,
and that the only thing that they would teach the uncircumcised what was the Ten Commandments. Not to stay away from blood, to
mm-hmm.
abstain from blood and things strangled, which are tenets of the law.
Yeah.
And to abstain from fornication, which is race mixing.
Right.
And which is race mixing in the vernacular in which Paul used it.
Right.
And the apostles used it. So that's all they had to teach. There was no and to remember the poor of the people in Jerusalem, because they couldn't work for a living. The Jews had totally oppressed them.
Right, as is happening today. They're depriving us of our jobs, exporting them overseas. Yeah, same thing going on. Now here, this first sentence, these emphatic declarations of independence, was Paul declaring himself to be independent of Peter, James, and John?
Well, Paul also told all the assemblies that that he wouldn't rule over their faith.
Right.
You know, all Christians are supposed to be independent.
Mm-hmm.
We are all equal and have one
right.
master. And the Jew evidently doesn't understand that.
Right, right.
The Jew writing the article doesn't. Tobin does not understand that.
Yeah, but here what Tobin is saying is because Paul accused them of hypocrisy, that he is declaring independence from them, and you know they should teach what they teach, and I'm going to teach what I'm going to teach. Was there any such schism?
There was no such schism because they all taught from the scripture.
Right, right. And then he says the purposeful minimization of the importance of the leadership and the example of the incident at Antioch all point us to the accusation being made against him by the opposing mission. Two lies here. Number one, he did not purposely minimize their importance. And number two, they didn't make any accusations against him. This is blatant. Well, I should say it's subtle. Hypocrisy.
Well, it's the all through the book of Acts, the account of Paul's adversaries are the Edomite Jews.
Right.
And they have nothing to do with the people in Jerusalem.
That's right.
And it's very well documented.
Yes, yes. And so it's very obvious that the purpose of this deception is to lead people away from the Edomite Jews, who are the real enemies of Paul. That's the whole point of Paul Tobin's deception, okay?
And it was the Edomite Jews that killed James.
That's right.
Josephus records that it was the Edomites that killed James.
Yeah, yeah. And he ignores that. I mean, he ignores that question altogether. Who was it that killed James? Paul certainly had nothing to do with that, okay?
Well, James, you know, he was murdered 4 years after Paul's arrest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, by the Jews, by the Edomite Jews, by the Pharisees. Exactly, yeah. And so then he says, because of all of these accusations, the implied rift between the Jerusalem church and Paul, he says, they also tell us the identity of the accusers. But there's no accusation. There's no evidence of any accusation. It's all contrived in his head.
No, this is all, it's conjecture upon conjecture. It's what
yeah.
the Paul bashers do.
Right, right. So this is, you know, but like I said, if someone who's listening to this, who's already got it in for Paul, and he reads an argument like this, which is all conjecture and false accusations and false claims, they're really going to hate Paul after he pits Paul against Peter, James, and John, okay, which is what he is doing, Okay.
Well, he uses, you know, Paul mentions, throughout 1 Corinthians, Paul is admonishing the Corinthians for picking their favorite apostle and claiming to be a follower of that apostle.
Yeah. Hero.
But that, yeah, you know, just because the Corinthians are doing that, that doesn't mean that the apostles themselves are opposed to each other.
Right. Right.
That has nothing at all to do with it.
Right.
I mean, we could be rooting for a baseball team and all have our favorite player.
Sure.
But we still want the team to win.
Right.
Yeah, you know what? I mean, I know that's a bad analogy.
Yeah, well, it's not like Joel Osteen versus Joyce Meyer. Maybe that's a better example.
Well, right. And in reality, they're both working on the same team. They're both working for the Jews.
That's right. That's right. So there we've got a real complaint. If Paul were suggesting that Peter, James, and John were actually Jews, Edomite Jews, then we could take this whole thing seriously.
Well, right, but Paul treats, yeah, you know, he throughout 1 Corinthians where he mentions them.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's 4 times. It's Cephas or Peter
right.
is mentioned in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, chapter 3, chapter 9, and chapter 15.
Mm-hmm.
But it's always in a positive light. And he's telling the Corinthians that they're the ones that are choosing favorites.
Right, right.
And they shouldn't be.
Yeah.
That you know, one builds and another waters. And Paul says that. Yeah, you know, he builds in Apollo waters, or he plants in Apollo waters, or Yahweh plants and Paul waters, and Apollo does the trimming. It doesn't matter. What he's saying is everybody has their role.
Yeah.
And he doesn't mention Cephas or Peter in that analogy, so Tobin automatically says that he must be his enemy.
Right.
But that's not true for the text at all.
That's right. That's right.
Tobin
just because
is just,
you don't. Just because you don't praise somebody doesn't mean you hate him.
Well, right. But,
yeah.
But Paul is not in any negative way of treating Peter in this writing, and Tobin is inventing it.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's like if I had come out and said, I like Clifton Emmaheiser's writing, and I failed to mention that I like Bill Fink's writing, his conclusion is that I hate Bill Fink.
Well, right.
That's the argument he's making.
Exactly. That's exactly the argument he's making.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's not a valid argument at all.
Right. It's ridiculous.
And any claim about the ancient past or any claim about the scripture, any claim about history, I mean, there's a million or 10 million scenarios that can be worked up, and they're all novels without documentary evidence.
Right, right. And so this is the nature, folks, of, you know, now we're not even talking about the blatant, deception and the blatant misrepresentation of Paul by the evangelistic churches, you know, this is Paul bashing. And what we have to understand is that the false interpretations of Paul by the evangelizers are the basis of all this Paul bashing. Okay, namely the Paul bashers accept these false interpretations about Paul, and then they say, well, if this is what Paul is really like, then he can't possibly be an identity Christian, okay? And Paul Tobin is feeding into that mentality, which was begun by the false interpretations of Paul in the first place, okay? He is deliberately feeding into that mentality, and he's taking advantage of the Paul bashers. That's what he's doing, okay? Let me continue here. By relating the incident at Antioch, Paul was showing how he had in the past confronted such a problem against Peter and James. Okay, there was this problem of hypocrisy, right? No doubt about that. Since he did not qualify his example in any way, whatever that means, it provides strong evidence that his opponents had the support of James and the Jerusalem church. So in other words, they're saying, the friend of my enemy is my enemy. Okay, that's what he's saying here. So we can construct the opponent's arguments in something like this. Now he's putting words in Paul's mouth. All apostles must be approved by the Jerusalem church. Paul himself acquired his mission from the Jerusalem church like we do, but he is preaching in an irresponsible manner, eschewing the importance of the Mosaic laws even for the Gentiles, which is not approved by James and the rest of the leadership, unquote. So this is how we're supposed to interpret this dispute between Paul and the Jerusalem church, according to Paul Tobin.
Well, it's recorded in Acts 15 where they discuss putting the Antiochian non-Judahites or non-Judeans, the uncircumcised of Antioch, where it's discussed about whether or not they should be circumcised. And once you're circumcised, you have to keep the whole law.
Right.
That was their attitude.
Right.
Now, Peter said, or maybe it was James that said, it's right in Acts chapter 15, do not lay a yoke upon the neck of the disciples that our fathers could not bear.
Right. Right.
It's very clear.
Yeah. So he was deferring to Paul. Okay.
Well, right. They fully supported Paul in that.
Yes. Yes. So Paul Tobin is saying that no, this caused.
Well, Paul Tobin's a Jew and a Judaizer.
That's right.
And the Paul bashers, they're Jews and
they're Judaizers. And they follow the Judaizers, but they don't know it. They actually think they're being true to identity by being led around by the nose by these Judaizers.
Well, right. And worshiping identity, they deny Christ.
Right. Right. They just got it all wrong because they don't understand the true teachings of Paul. So let me give his final comments on this episode. We can summarize our study of the opponents of Paul in Galatia. They were Jewish Christians. Okay? So here's this false idea of there's no such thing as a Jewish Christian. Okay? You're either a Judahite or an Idumean. Okay? That's the important distinction. Okay? And no Idumeans, no Edomites, become Christians. But Judahites can become Christians, okay? And, of course, Paul Tobin doesn't make any distinction between Judeans, Judahites, and Edomites.
Well, no, the Paul bashers never do.
And they don't either.
And the Paul bashers despise Paul for going to the Gentiles.
Right.
Not realizing that they are those Gentiles.
Exactly. Exactly, because they've been fooled
because
by the word. Yeah.
Yeah, they've been fooled by the mistranslation.
Yeah, they've been fooled by the improper usage of the word Gentile. They've been fooled by the improper usage of the word Jewish, okay? Which there's no such thing as a Jewish Christian. There's Judahite Christians, but they're... X asks, can some Jews be converted? I don't know. They say they can.
Well, the Edomites...
In
the first century B.C., the Edomite Jews stole this identity.
Yes.
And thought they had it locked up.
Mm-hmm.
Thought they had a seal on it.
Right.
And it's very telling in Acts chapters 21, 22, 23, 24. In one of those, I think it's Acts chapter 23 maybe, Paul is arrested and he stands on the stairs and gives a speech in Hebrew.
Mm-hmm.
Which the captain of the guard allowed him to do.
Yes.
And he's speaking to the people that wanted to kill him.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, a few minutes before that, they wanted to stone him to death, right?
Yeah.
Without a trial. And he gives them this long speech about their fathers, and some of them were Judah, and some of them were Edomites, but they were all traditionalists.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, they were all anti-Christian for one reason or another.
Right, right.
And he gives them this speech, and it's at the point where he tells them that it's his mission to deliver the gospel to the nations far off. Meaning
yes.
The nations of the dispersed Israelites.
Exactly.
That's the point where they riot.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
At that point in Paul's speech, they riot.
Yes. Yes.
And that's because they're about to lose the identity theft, that they're about to be busted.
Right. Right.
And that's the point they riot.
Right.
They start throwing dirt in the air and they got to pull Paul out of there then.
Right. Yeah, the police actually have to save his butt from the rioters. Yes. It's a good thing at that point that he was a Roman citizen, because otherwise they would have killed him right then and there.
Oh, right. But that's Yahweh's plan.
Yes, exactly, exactly. So anyway, he says, continuing here, they were Jewish Christians, according to him. Okay, of course, we know there is no such thing. Who preached the continued validity of the Mosaic laws. Okay, now that's accurate. If we're talking about Judahite Christians, okay, who were probably wavering, and there were some true Judahites who really hadn't heard it. And this is the true mission that Paul had to the Judeans, was to explain to them that the ritual laws were no longer in effect. The Levitical priesthood was no longer offering sacrifices for the remission of sins. He was telling them, this is no longer valid because you have been redeemed by the Messiah. Therefore, these sacrifices are no longer necessary. Okay. And this was the hardest thing for Paul to get across to the true Judahites who had what? For 2,000 years been practicing these sacrifices.
Well, right. And it takes a lot of Old Testament study to see that, you know,
right,
the Messiah would do away with the sacrifice.
Right. And so some of these people were legitimately arguing against Paul. They're the true Judahites. But as you say, the Edomite Pharisees saw Paul as wrecking their game.
Well, right. He was a huge threat
yes.
to their authority.
Right, exactly, because they had assumed control, authority over the ritual sacrifices and the oblations, blah, blah, blah.
And just like Christ was a huge threat to their authority,
that's
then
right.
followed up Paul.
That's right. So Paul cannot possibly be a Judaizer in the proper sense of the word of Jews, okay? And certainly he's not a Judaizer in the sense of promoting the traditional beliefs of the true Judahites. He was trying to explain to them about the redemption.
Well, right. And if the Paul bashers want to bash Paul, they should go. They should start sacrificing pigeons and lambs this weekend.
Yeah, right.
I think.
Exactly.
I want to see them. I want to see the pictures of Russell Walker and Athena and
yeah, right.
all the rest of those turkeys
yeah.
sacrificing pigeons.
Very good.
And lambs.
Very good point. Very good point, Bill. Okay, so let me finish this sentence. They were Jewish Christians who had preached the continued validity of the Mosaic laws, and that's why they were considered the circumcision, okay? But Paul only accepts Judahites of the circumcision. He does not accept Edomites of the circumcision, okay? Even for Gentiles, he says, okay, that the traditionalists, and that's true. Well, actually, no, wait a minute. Let's examine this sentence. They were Jewish Christians who preached the continued validity of the Mosaic laws, even for Gentiles. That's a false statement.
That's an absolutely false statement, unless we're talking about the, I'm sorry, the name of the sect is lost on me.
Okay, Ebionites?
Yes, thank you, the Ebionites.
Okay.
All right, they were Judaizing and claimed to be Christians.
Mm-hmm.
Basically.
Right.
But they weren't, they had nothing to do with James and Peter.
Right. That's
what
right.
did they have to do with James and Peter?
Yeah, nothing. Yeah, they were.
Connecting a second right. century sect, to right. Jewish sect to James and Peter.
Right. Right. But this is a blatant lie that not even the Edomite Jews, the scribes and Pharisees, were wanting to go out to preach and convert the Gentiles.
And have them do the sacrifice.
Right, exactly.
Right, of course not.
And neither were the traditionalists. That is, the true Judaites. They weren't intending to go out to convert the Gentiles. That was the whole dispute between Peter and Paul in the first place. Okay? That, we don't need to circumcise these people.
well, right. And it was settled in Acts chapter 15.
Yeah. And Peter, James, and John agreed. Yeah, we don't need to do that.
and the only way that Paul Tobin can dispute that is to write his own Bible.
Right. So this statement is blatantly false.
But that's what the Paul bashers do. They write
yeah.
their own Bible.
Yeah. The circumcision, the circumcisers, had no intention of circumcising the Gentiles. None whatsoever. It's a blatantly false statement, okay? Another couple more sentences here.
Unless they could make a few bucks on the side.
Yeah, right, exactly. Oh, yeah, well, they did do that. They would convert for a price. And they still do that today.
That's clear from the literature.
Yes, yes. And also, even today, to gain admittance to a synagogue, you have to pay. You have to pay for a seat in the synagogue, okay? Just like
a seat on the stock market, huh?
Exactly, exactly, yes. They questioned Paul's authority to preach and his apostleship. No, they did not. That's another lie. They claimed the support of the Jerusalem church headed by James. Okay, well.
Why would James accept Paul's presence in Acts chapter 22?
Right.
Why would if there was such enmity between them as Paul describes,
mm-hmm.
why would James even admit him to his company?
Right. Yeah.
If he's this big shot in this Jerusalem church, and I'm using Tobin's own language, You know, he's the Pope of Jerusalem, right? According to Tobin.
Right.
And so why would he accept Paul into his presence?
Yeah.
If Paul's his enemy.
Yeah. And he gives no evidence of any accusations by either James, Peter, or Paul.
Well, what I'm being sarcastic and trying to explain that Tobin misportrays everybody.
That's right. That's right. He misportrays everybody in order to make Paul look bad. Yeah, and it misrepresents everything. There's not a single accurate statement being made in this document. Not a single accurate statement. It's all lies. Every last word of it. And this is 11 pages of small type. Okay.
And the Paul Bashers eat this stuff up.
And they eat it up. They eat it up.
You know, it's like eating off Satan, the leftovers from Satan's steak dinner plate.
It's blessed pork. Right. Right. Okay. All right, let's go on. Now, he's talking here about 1 Corinthians 3, 4 through 15. Let me just quote a couple of the passages here. And this is Paul saying, "For when one of you says, I belong to Paul, another, I belong to Apollos," you brought this passage up earlier, "and you are you not merely men? What then is Apollos? What is Paul? Servants whom you believed as the Lord assigned to teach. I planted, Apollos watered, but God gave the growth." Okay? So here's his comment on these passages. The passage above has been separated into two paragraphs to make Paul's meaning clearer. In verses 4 to 9, a metaphor was used of that of a garden. He referred to himself as planting the seed of the church in Corinth. Okay? He uses the word church, which is not the correct terminology. And to Apollos watering it. All pointing towards a friendly cooperation between these two. Note also, and that's between Paul and Apollos. Note also the metaphor of growing a garden implied that the gardeners were external to the garden, that they were outsiders. This is confirmed by the fact that both Paul and Apollos were not from Corinth, very obviously, okay? The second section, 1 Corinthians 15, utilized a different metaphor, that of laying a foundation of a building. Again, the metaphor implied an external agent. But here, the tone is darker. Okay? He says the tone is darker. Let me quote verses
3. Well, this is Freudian psychobabble applied to Paul's epistle.
That's right. That's right. Well, let me quote verses 13 to 15 to see if there's any darkness here. Now, starting from verse 12. "Now, if anyone builds on a foundation with gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, stubble, each man's work will become manifest. For the day will disclose." He's talking about the judgment day. "Will disclose whether your work is good or evil. Because it will be revealed with fire. And the fire will test what sort of work each one has done. If the work which any man has built upon the foundation survives, he will receive a reward. If any man's work is burned up, he will suffer loss, though he himself will be saved, but only as through fire." So the mere fact that he brings up this connotation of fire somehow makes these passages dark, right?
Well, it's the same testing fire that Peter talked about in his epistle.
Exactly, that the whole Bible talks about from beginning to end.
Right. Well, Tobin is taking advantage of naive Christians.
Exactly.
Or naive people who think they're Christians.
So he's claiming that Paul now has this darker tone. Okay. "But here the tone is darker. No longer do we find a cooperative tone of planting the seed and watering it. Paul claimed that another man is building upon the foundation which he had laid, and subtly caution the man to take care." Okay, so
now there's no particular man being spoken of here.
Uh-huh, right.
Which is a total lie. It's the same deception they use in John chapter 5.
Mm-hmm.
"If anyone comes in his own name, him you'll believe."
Right.
It's the same exact deception. There is no particular person being mentioned here.
Right.
Paul's saying, you know, Christ laid the foundation,
yeah,
and we have to build upon it.
Right.
And yeah, and if anyone lays gold and silver, he'll be rewarded. And if anyone lays
right
hay and stubble,
right,
and that's anyone in general. It's no
yeah
particular person being referenced.
Well, no, it must be Paul, Bill. It has to be
Paul.
Well,
he wants it to be Peter. He wants it to be Peter.
Right.
Because Apollo is mentioned, you know, is watering, but Peter's not mentioned.
But the verse,
Peter's not in Corinth.
Right. The verse you're citing, the Paul bashers say, oh, he must mean Paul, because Paul comes in his own name. No,
well,
he doesn't.
Right. Yeah, right.
Paul never came in his own name.
Never.
Never.
And he doesn't mean anybody in particular.
Right. It's nobody in particular. Anyone who comes in his own name. And if you follow that person who comes in his own name, claims to be an expert, preaching a different gospel, well, then you're a fool for following that person. Okay? Right. And it could be the Pope. It could be Paul. It could be anybody. That's your point, correct?
Absolutely.
It doesn't single out any particular individual.
No.
Okay? But he's implying that it does. Okay? So Paul claimed that another man is building upon a foundation which he had laid and subtly cautioned the man to take care. He warned against using any other foundation apart from Jesus Christ. That's true. He finally made a true statement here. Then he alluded to a test with fire, which could burn up the work leading to loss. Whoever this other man is, here he goes. It's got to be some particular person. We can conclude from the tone of the whole paragraph that Paul is criticizing him, hinting the work done by this person was at best suspect and would be liable to be burned up if he does not take care.
And this is a Canaanite bait and switch game, because that's what.
Yeah.
That's nothing like what Paul's talking about.
Right. Now, take note of the expressions he's using. There's a hint. There's a subtle suggestion. Now, in the next paragraph, he says, there are a few clues that lead us to the identity of this unnamed person. Okay? The use of the metaphor of a building and the term foundation immediately brings to mind the Jerusalem pillars. Can you believe this? The mere fact that he uses the word foundation means that he must be referring to the Jerusalem pillars. Can you believe this?
Well, it's absolute conjecture. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, it's nonsense. It's absolute nonsense. But people who are already full of hate for Paul are going to say, yeah, wow, Paul must really be meaning this James, Peter, and John, okay?
Well, you know, he wasn't afraid to mention James, Peter, and John in Galatians chapter 2.
He wasn't afraid to accuse them to their faces of hypocrisy either.
And why wouldn't he be talking about them here?
Right.
I mean, Paul's not talking in parables.
Right. If he wasn't afraid to accuse them to their face, why would he be oblique here? That's what he's suggesting. He's coy. He's suggesting that Paul is being subtle.
And Paul's not being subtle at all.
No, it's Tobin is being subtle, right?
And he's talking about himself. I mean, 2 Corinthians 3:1, do we begin to introduce ourselves? It's, you know, he's talking about himself. He's talking about what he does. He's talking about what Apollos does.
Right.
He's not talking about anybody else.
Right, right. I mean, Paul is... this guy Tobin is just concocting a fictitious story through a myriad of subtle interpretations that the text simply does not suggest at all. Okay? But, you know, so you can take, you know, I suppose if you wanted to, you could take Hitler's Mein Kampf and twist his words to make him say, I love Jews. You know? If you take this approach, this psychobabble approach, You can make a guy say anything.
Well, that's what Jews do.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So he said, let me just finish this sentence here. There are a few clues that lead us to the identity of this unnamed person. The use of the metaphor of a building and the term foundation immediately brings to mind Jerusalem pillars, right? Okay, in his mind it does, which consisted of James, Peter, and John. Okay. So he's saying the person is actually three people. Here, too, the metaphor is that of a building.
Well, the problem with that is that James and Peter and John, they're not in Corinth laying any foundation.
Right.
He's talking, the whole context of this is the assembly in Corinth.
Right.
All right. And some of them were following. Peter was writing letters to these people.
Right.
And there's no doubt, but Peter's letters are signed from Babylon.
Uh-huh.
Peter is not in Corinth.
Right.
There's absolutely no evidence that Peter was ever in Corinth.
Yes.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, Peter wrote to the assemblies of Asia, which is opposite the Ionian Sea from Corinth.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no doubt these people knew of Peter, and there's no doubt they knew of his letters.
Right.
But Paul is talking about those who are in Corinth building the assembly.
Mm-hmm.
And evidently there are some Judaizers.
Yes.
Who have been trying to spoil this assembly.
Sure.
And
sure.
Paul is
As
talking
always.
About them
right.
with wooden stay and hay and stubble.
Right.
But that has nothing to do with the Jerusalem church.
That's right.
And Peter and
he's speaking
and
in general.
James and John are totally out of the context here.
Right.
That there's absolutely no reason to imagine them being in the context.
Yes. But now, speaking of context, he brings into the context a verse that has nothing to do with this context. Let me quote. This brings to mind the Matthean verse, that is from Matthew, the Matthean verse which had Jesus saying to Peter, which remember means rock, you are Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church, Matthew 16:18. Regardless of the historicity of this passage in Matthew, it points to a tradition which relates Peter the rock to the foundation of the church. The above two considerations strongly points to Peter being the other man in Paul's criticism above.
Well, you know, Petros means a stone.
Okay.
It doesn't mean a rock. It
okay.
means a little stone.
Right.
And Peter himself in his epistle said, we are all living stones.
Right.
In the building of the body
yeah.
of Joshua.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, if Paul is making a play on words with stone here in the foundation, then he would be saying that Peter would be a solid part of the foundation.
Right.
Not
okay.
wood, hay, or stubble.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, you know, so,
you
so that works against Mr. Tobin.
Exactly.
Yeah, you know, and that it doesn't wash in the first place because it's entirely out of context.
Mm-hmm.
But it certainly isn't, you know, if Paul was trying to draw that analogy, then he has to be speaking positively of Peter.
Exactly.
And not negatively.
Yeah, like the three little pigs. He built his shack with brick instead of hay and stubble. Right.
Well, right. And stone doesn't burn, and that's the most any of us could hope for is
right.
to be a stone in that foundation.
So if his context were correct, Paul would actually be praising Peter.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he would be comparing stone, which doesn't disappear in fire,
right.
to wood, stay in hay and stubble, which does.
Yes, yes.
So Tobin's just a moron.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, Jews, the deceitful Jew thinks he's too smart for his own good.
That's right.
All the time.
Well, I can imagine. Boy, this is a really clever one. They'll never catch this lie. That's how they think.
Yeah, right.
Uh huh. That's how they think. Yeah. So therefore, he says, we can conclude that there is a very high probability. Bordering on certainty, no proof, mind you, that Paul is here polemicizing either against Peter or against the opponents who were in Corinth preaching in Peter's name. So he assumes that there are people representing Peter in Corinth.
And we see
Paul.
Absolutely no evidence of that anywhere.
Okay.
There's no evidence of that,
yeah.
especially in the Bible.
Yeah.
But there's no evidence of that at all.
Right. Yeah.
I've never read one instance
yeah.
of Peter sending apostles.
Well,
out
now, wait
Greek
a minute, Bill, this must be the case.
Well, of course it must, because the Jews' whole premise
right.
relies on
it. Must be the case. It absolutely must be the case. Don't you get it, Bill? It must be the case.
Well, the Jews, the Paul Bashers' entire premise relies on it.
Exactly. Talk about sophisticated psychology and sophisticated subtle deception. That's what we're dealing with here. Okay, then he says, we have established, after all of this very high probability, bordering on certainty, strongly points, series of hints. Okay? This is his own language. And then with these subtle hints, he says, we have established. that Paul was polemicizing against the missionaries that were responsible for the Cephas party.
Well, Always Established is a novel. That's
yeah.
Always Established. He hasn't established anything.
He has written a novel. And it's setting Paul up for a big fall. It's a novel. That's what it is. There's not a word of truth in anything he said.
Well, right. If he had to stand trial with this, he'd be hung. I mean,
oh, right.
I'd throw a rope over the branch in a second.
And then he asked the question, do we have any evidence that it was this group that made the accusation against Paul's apostleship? There wasn't any accusation. He never even, you know, he twisted the words to make it sound like an accusation. And that was simply based on the fact that Paul refused to accept money from the Corinthians. Okay? So in other words, the accusation, he's saying that Peter, John, and Paul were accused, James were accusing Paul of being a false prophet because he refused to accept money.
Well, right. When a major premise of the second letter to the Corinthians, that in fact most of the second half of that letter is about a collection that the Corinthians are taking up, that Paul is going to accompany them with
mm-hmm.
to Jerusalem.
Right. So how
and they're taking it up. They took it up at Paul's urging.
Right. Right. So Paul was doing good. on behalf of the Jerusalem church, no less.
Well, right. So the whole, you know, in context, this whole thing this is the ground that the Paul bashers stand on.
Right.
And there's eggshells with nothing under them.
Right. Except rotten yolks. Rotten oaks and rotten eggs. That's what this is. And then he says, do we have any evidence that this was the group that made the accusation against Paul's apostle? There was no accusation to begin with. We saw above in 1 Corinthians 9 and 15, there is a series of hints. This is how he establishes the proof.
We don't
right?
establish doctrine on a series of hints.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, a Jew might.
Yeah, right. There are a series of hints that point in this direction. Okay? This is the argument this guy puts together. It's incredible. In 1 Corinthians 9, 5, 6, Paul compares the right of the other apostles, the brother of the Lord and Cephas, versus his and Barnabas's right to receive payment for their missionary work. The inclusion of Barnabas is surprising at first, for nowhere is he mentioned as being in Corinth. However, the parallelism between Paul and Barnabas on the one hand and Peter, the brothers of the Lord, which includes James and the apostles on the other, okay, he is creating this wall of separation between Paul and the Jerusalem, you know, Peter, James, and John, intimating that they are more real than Paul is. You know, he's got a very subtle way of preaching this, right? There we had Paul and Barnabas on one side and James, Peter, and John on the other. Paul's rhetorical question on why only he and Barnabas had no right to be paid seems to be sarcastically pointing to the opponents as being allied with the circumcision group. Is there any indication in Paul's writing that James, Peter, and John were saying that Paul had no right to accept money from the Corinthians?
No, of course not. There's
mm-hmm.
nothing in Scripture about it.
Right.
And Paul is collecting money from the Corinthians to bring to them.
Exactly. Exactly.
And what Tobin, you know, Tobin completely ignores the fact that at this point in history, James and, Peter's
yeah.
probably already in Babylon.
Right.
But
right.
even early on, you know, in Acts chapter 15, in the early sixth decade of the first century, the Christians at Jerusalem are a tiny, insignificant sect.
Yes.
With maybe a couple of thousand followers spread throughout the land that are totally oppressed by
right.
the Pharisaical authorities of the temple.
Right. Right.
And the synagogues spread all throughout the Oikoumene, and they are the real adversaries of Christianity.
Right.
And that's extremely clear in the Gospels, in the Acts, in Paul's epistles, and in Josephus' histories.
Mm-hmm.
All right?
Yeah.
That these people are, these anti-Christian Edomite Jews are spread out throughout the Oikoumene,
right.
or the inhabited earth. they are the enemies of Christianity, and Tobin doesn't even, he excludes them from the picture entirely.
Yes, that's right.
And he seems to have, you know, he
right.
seems to draw a picture of this huge Christian church in Jerusalem
right.
with all of this might and authority.
Yes.
And this Paul opposing it and being a rebel against it.
Yes.
And eventually winning over all of Christendom
right.
against the real Christian church in Jerusalem.
Yes.
The whole thing that Tobin sets up is an absolute, it's a fantasy.
Yes.
There's nothing real here about this entire paper.
But
every sentence is built on a false premise.
But, Bill, the situation you just described, that is exactly how our Judeo-Christian people surmise was the case. That this is what he's describing here is what most Christians actually believe, is that James, Peter, and John had this church, this very vibrant, strong church in Jerusalem.
They were in hiding in Jerusalem.
Right. And that Paul was opposing them and going out to the Gentiles against their wishes. So that
well, which is what the Jew would want Christians to believe.
Exactly. Exactly. And so he is what he's doing, he's playing into that fantasy by giving that fantasy more life.
Well, right, and this is the stuff that the Paul Bashers base their theories on.
Yeah, and they don't understand that they're being deceived. They just
well,
don't understand.
Well, absolutely, and they're not only being deceived, but they're so ignorant that they're part of the deception.
Right, right. Okay, so let me see. That concludes the section on Corinthians and Galatians. Let me see here. Okay, let me just jump over here to his comments. We've got about 5 minutes left. 2 Corinthians 1 through 15 through 18, where Paul is quoted, "Because I was sure of this, I wanted to come to you first so that you might have a double pleasure. I wanted to visit you on my way to Macedonia and to come back to you from Macedonia and have you send me on my way to Judea. Was I vacillating when I wanted to do this? Do I make my plans like a worldly man, ready to say yes and no at once? As surely as God is faithful, our word to you has not been yes and no." So what is Paul really saying here before I give Paul Tobin's comments here?
Well, he's basically saying that it's not that he broke a promise, but it was for their own behavior and the fact that he did not want to come chastising them, that he did not stop by
okay.
Corinthia on his way to Macedonia.
Okay, so here's what Paul Tobin has to say. So Paul's opponents were saying that Paul was unskilled in speaking, had an unimpressive presence, that he did not accept payment from the Corinthian congregation, that he actually defrauded them, and that he changed his travel plans at whim.
Well, yep. Well, right, but Paul is not... He's not addressing people outside of the Corinthian congregation here.
Uh-huh.
He's addressing critics from within the Corinthian congregation.
Right. But what a radically different interpretation.
And those same critics are the same people who were sort of on the side of the fornicator
yeah.
in 1 Corinthians.
Yes. So he's making up another false accusation that somebody's accusing Paul of defrauding the Corinthians.
And no, there are no outside accusations
yeah.
here at all.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
The entire context of this epistle is Paul's chastising of certain elements within the Corinthians congregation.
Right.
And the fact that the congregation was being affected from without by certain Judaizers,
yeah,
but not by James and Peter and John.
Yeah, right, exactly. And those Judaizers were almost always Edomite Jews, not any true Judahites.
Well, right. They were probably just Edomites from the local Corinthian synagogue.
Right, exactly, exactly. Okay, so let me just quote one more sentence from Mr. Tobin here. "In general, they said Paul did not have the proper qualifications to be an apostle. Paul, of course, gave as good as he got. He
well, most qualifications are never, ever challenged in the New Testament.
Right, right. Certainly not by Peter, James, and John.
Only the Paul Bashers.
Yes, only the Paul
only
Bashers.
Only modern-day Paul Bashers who follow the Jews
mm-hmm.
and the homosexual lobby
right.
and the civil rights lobby, they're the people that challenge Paul's qualification.
And along these lines of reasoning is why
in the first century, And even like Marciano, yeah, you know, Marciano we mentioned?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, he tried to form Paul in his image.
That's right.
Even in the first century and the second century, the early church writings of the church fathers.
Yeah, Marciano.
Nobody challenges Paul's authority.
Yeah, Marciano.
They all try to pervert what he said.
Yes, it's perversion, total perversion, because Marciano was the first one to go against the Old Testament and to start idolizing Paul as an antinomian, which he was not. He was neither.
Well, nobody in the New Testament and none of the early church Christian writers, that there's no evidence that Paul's apostleship is challenged.
Yes.
At all.
Yeah. Okay.
It's a modern-day Jewish device.
Yes. Okay. One more, a couple more sentences here. I think it's just one more, actually. He, Paul, called his opponents servants of Satan, 2 Corinthians 11:5, false apostles and deceitful workers. It sounds like this was a no-holds-barred contest. So what he's saying is that Paul is accusing Peter, James, and John of being servants of Satan, false apostles, and deceitful workers. That's how he's twisting Paul's words here.
And that Paul's not addressing them at all.
Right. They have nothing to do with the situation.
Nothing at all.
And aren't you saying that this whole situation... Peter, James, and John, any of them actually alive at this point? Well, John would have been. But I think you said that James was already...
No, they're all three of them are alive in 2 Corinthians.
They're
still
alive.
2 Corinthians is written about 55 B.C., 54,
okay.
54, 55 A.D.
Yeah.
They're all still alive at this point.
Right.
But okay. There's absolutely no evidence. Paul hasn't been in touch with them in at least 3 years.
Okay.
From the time he left, you know, Antioch.
Right.
And there's absolutely no evidence that they're even in the picture.
Right. And he's not talking about them at all. When he uses the term servants of Satan, he's talking about the Edomites.
He's in the middle in this letter of taking up a collection for them.
Yeah.
So how could he be saying those things about
them? Right.
Him?
It's ridiculous.
And the validity of the collection is going to be proved because Paul is telling the Corinthians and he's telling the Macedonians to elect somebody of their own number to deliver it.
Right. So that
he's
not
saying, give me the money, I'm going to make off with
it. He made that stipulation just so that he couldn't be accused.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. And the people that hope to trick you with this, you know, 2 Corinthians chapter 1, are the same people that hope you don't read 2 Corinthians chapters 10 through 12.
Again, all let's call this sophisticated Bible criticism. All of this modernistic, sophisticated Bible criticism has been influenced by the Jews. It totally depends upon Christians not reading these scriptures.
Well, now, right. I don't even think Tobin's read them all.
Probably not. But he's read them enough to twist them in all kinds of pretzels. Right? And so this kind of commentary totally relies on the ignorance of the Christians regarding these verses, regarding these epistles. Because if you actually, because we've just gone through 1st and 2nd Corinthians, and we know what they're about. They're not at all about what Paul Tobin is suggesting.
No, he's just a Jew and a liar.
Right.
And any Paul basher is following Jews just this.
Yes.
Because all of the original devices invented in modern literature against Paul of Tarsus come from these Jews.
That's right. That's right. And so, you know, so you really have to appreciate, first of all, you have to know these scriptures very well to first understand what they're actually about. And if you, and lacking that, you become susceptible to these Jewish perturbations and distortions of what these scriptures are actually about. And if you're susceptible to both of those things, number one, ignorance, and number one, the lies, the deceptions, then you're going to believe these lies about Paul.
Right. They all fall apart once you understand the epistles in the context of the book of Acts.
Exactly.
And in the context of the chronology and history of the time.
Yeah. Now I sure hope that that this discussion isn't too confusing. You know, I'm sure for a lot of people it is, because we're talking about very sophisticated deception here. And that you have to have you must have a proper grounding in these scriptures to be able to accept anybody's distorted viewpoints. Okay? You have to be able to refute somebody's distortions of Paul. Okay.
It's clear that if Paul wanted to censure the apostles, he'd have written an epistle to them.
Yes.
Not an epistle to the Corinthians.
Yes, yes. But all of this innuendo suggesting that Paul is criticizing Peter, James, and John is absolute fiction. It's not there.
And doing that in an epistle to the Corinthians would reduce Paul to the level of a rumor monger and a slanderer.
Right.
And that's not the purpose of these epistles.
Yes. And
that's not why these epistles were preserved by scribes for 2,000 years.
Right.
Nobody in the first century, second century, third century, fourth century ever felt that was the purpose of these epistles.
Right.
Or else surely they would have never survived.
Exactly.
I mean, I got better things to do than to copy Dear Abby.
But, but wait a minute. Wait, Bill, you don't understand. They themselves are victims of Paul's deception. Don't you see?
Well, that's what the Jew would claim, yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. But as we've shown, there's nothing of anything like that in these scriptures. Absolutely nothing.
No, it's absolute. You've got to be an absolute idiot to fall for the devices of people
well,
like Paul.
But this is very clever, sophisticated stuff, which preys upon the ignorance of the average Christian and not having read these things. And number two, having been already misled by his evangelists to believe this nonsense.
But all you have to do is really read the Acts and read Paul's epistles.
Exactly.
And where you see places and people mentioned in Paul's epistles
that
match places and people mentioned in the Acts, that then you could match them right up and say, oh, well, that makes sense. This is why he said that, because it said this over here.
Exactly.
You know, and that's called reading in context.
In context. No, that's not how you're supposed to read the Bible. You take a verse from Peter, a verse from Paul, a verse from Ezekiel, a verse from Isaiah. You put them all together. Put them in a folder, right? Put them in a blender, and then it spits out a whole new doctrine.
Well, that's what the Judeo-Christian churches do.
That's right. That's right. And people believe the stuff that they say. That's why the churches are in such big trouble, not comprehending what the Bible's teaching at all. So, Bill, I thank you very much for participating in this exercise to expose how the Jewish mind works. We have to be ye therefore wise as serpents.
And I would just ask people, it's 180 pages, right?
Yeah.
To go at least look at William Fink versus the Paul Bashers on my website.
Yes, yes, because this is very subtle deception. They're accusing Paul of being a subtle deceiver, but the subtle deceptions are coming from his enemies, not the other way around, okay? And then once you understand that, once you perceive that that's what's really going on, then, the light, hopefully some of these Paul bashers will do as you suggest, read your article on the subject and realize that the deception is always on the other side. Obviously, there are some major mistranslations that are at fault here too, okay? But these Paul bashers, these deceivers, are exploiting those mistranslations and using those mistranslations to further deceive the people who should know better. Okay. So thank you very much, William Fink, for participating in this exercise. I hope it's instructive for people to not inordinately bash Paul, because there's all kinds of deception here. I think we've proven beyond any shadow of a doubt that Paul Tobin has totally misrepresented everything that Paul has said.
Well, he's a Jew, if his lips are moving, he's lying.
That's right. That's right. And that's what we have to understand about Jews. They're always deceiving us. They're always deceiving us. Never take the word of a Jew. And it pains me, William. It pains me that W.G. Finlay actually bought this stuff.
Well, who is a liar but they who deny that Yahshua is the Christ?
Right. You have to start with that premise. Exactly.
That has to be the foundation that you build it on.
Yes.
I mean, Yahshua Christ, and that's in the epistles of John. And Yahshua Christ, that's proven out by John 8:44. Where Yahshua told them that they do the works of their father, who is a liar from the beginning.
Yes, yes. All right, very good. So thank you all for listening. Thank you for helping me explain these things, Bill. I think it's very enlightening. And now, what's our plan next Saturday? I'm going to be gone.
I have to come up with a program for next Saturday. Okay. I haven't done that yet, and I'll probably do it by Monday, and it'll be announced on my website.
Okay, very good. And then the following weekend, you'll be gone, and so Greg Howard and I are going to do a two-night series, Friday and Saturday night, on the Book of Enoch and how it relates to current prophecy.
Oh, okay. I thought you were going to have the Paul Basher on.
No, that's supposed to be on Sunday.
Oh. Okay.
If he dares.
Okay.
Okay. So if not, then, you know, we'll have something else for that Sunday.
Well, he's easy because when you corner him, he just denies knowing anything.
Right.
I mean, I got it on tape, so.
Yeah. Okay.
Thanks to Mark. To Mark III.
Yes. Okay, very good. So, and then tomorrow I'm going to do part two of the Herodians, explaining how the Edomite Jews took over the nation of Judah and began pretending to be Judahites. So that's going to be a theme, part two tomorrow. Okay, so I want to invite everybody for that. That's going to be 11 Central, noon Eastern, on the Voice of Christian Israel. So, again, thank you all for listening. Praise Yahweh. The truth is coming out, folks.
Praise Yahweh.
Praise Yahweh.